The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. Hello, and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognises and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work, and fierce determination have changed society, lives, and the world in all kinds of inspiring ways. I'm Diane Kenwood. I'm a journalist and broadcaster, and I'm one of the team at Women of the Year. Saying that our guest on the Extraordinary Ordinary podcast today holds the Guinness World Record for the fastest marathon run dressed as a nut doesn't even begin to do justice to the absurd number of ridiculously difficult physical challenges that former Major in the Royal Army Medical Corps, Sally Orange, has undertaken in her ongoing quest to raise awareness of mental health issues. This is a woman who has run the hardest land race in the world, the brutal Marathon des Sables, and the Siberian ice race in Russia, who has skied 250 kilometres across the Arctic Circle and done the Arch to Arc triathlon, running from Marble Arch, swimming across the Channel, then cycling to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, who has led the first ever all-female wounded, injured and sick team to compete the world's most challenging cycling event, the Race Across America, and is the only woman to have run seven marathons in seven continents in 7 days. She was awarded the MBE in the King's First Birthday Honours List this year for services to charity and mental health, and we are extremely grateful that she has slowed down enough to join us today. Sally Orange, welcome to the Extraordinary Ordinary.
Oh, thank you, Diane. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me on.
That is a phenomenal list of achievements. And as I've already said, it doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of everything you've done. So first of all, though, I really wanted to say congratulations on the MBE. That is an extraordinary achievement.
Thank you. Yeah, it really still hasn't quite sunk in yet, because it is something that was just never, ever in my mind would happen. So 2nd of November is actually when I go along to the palace. So looking forward to that. And yeah, looking forward to getting a nice dress to go and wear for it.
Yeah, it'll make a change from what you're normally wearing, which presumably is either, because we're going to dig into this, dressed as a fruit, which is how you run most of your races, isn't it? You're dressed up.
It is. And I have actually spoke at Buckingham Palace dressed as an orange. So I've been once as a slice of orange and once as a segment of orange. So the Duke of Edinburgh has met me dressed as an orange. So I might tone it down this time. But then again, yeah, I might go as a banana or a pineapple.
Well, I would imagine if you do, you'll be the first person ever to be awarded an MBE dressed like that.
Well, you've got to be you. That's what I always say to people.
Absolutely right. Let's step right back then and find out how and why this all started. Why did you begin to set yourself these extraordinary physical challenges?
So, yeah, going back, you know, as you mentioned, I served in the military for 22 years as a physiotherapist. And unfortunately, while I was there in the army, I had struggles with depression and chronic anxiety. And looking back, it's sort of 20 odd years that I've had those problems. And unfortunately, it did get to a point where I wanted to take my life. I was really, really unwell. And, you know, just as the small stepping stones to getting better, I started, you know, literally started by coming downstairs in the house, because I went for 2 months when I didn't even leave the house and leaving my room. So first of all, it started with actually coming downstairs and then going out and then going for walks and then building up and then going for runs and then suddenly going, yeah, I'll try a marathon. I remember always watching that very first London Marathon and thinking, wow, that looks amazing. I'd love to do that. It just took until I was 34 until I actually plucked up the courage to actually go and do a marathon myself.
So you didn't actually start doing all these things that you've done until you were in your early 30s?
No. I had run when I was younger, when I was 16, but unfortunately broke my leg then and had to have metal work in it, and physical activity wasn't after that anything that I really got back to, until I was 34.
Good Lord. So let's just, again, revisit what happened to you when you started to struggle with your mental health. Were you still in the army at that point?
I was still serving. And quite often people ask me what exactly what it was that triggered the depression. Now, I think I'd already always been a very anxious child, but back in them days, I was just called a worrier. I was just sensitive. But an accumulation of things, really, a bit like if you were to say to someone, you know, what started your cancer? There isn't always an exact reason. I really do just think it was an accumulation of things. It was a challenging environment, the forces. And I am sensitive. I know that I'm sensitive. But actually, I then start to look at that as a strength, because in my profession as a physiotherapist, it's quite handy to be sensitive, because you can understand when people are struggling or where they're finding things difficult. Back to when it affected me, it just, you know, low self-confidence, low mood. I was just crying, you know, all the time. And I got to a point where I just couldn't see that the world, I just felt the world would be much better off without me in it, because I just felt a burden to other people. And it was hard work. It was tiring and draining, and it wasn't a particularly pleasant time. And it's still with me. I'm not going to say that it's completely gone, but I manage it a lot better now because of the help and support that I've had. And so that sort of brings my desire to want other people never to get to that same place that I got to, which is sort of given me a completely new purpose, I guess, and why I now do the things that I do in the way that I do them.
That long ago, mental health wasn't something that people talked about openly and certainly didn't share conversations about. And I wonder how it was for you and in the army, and both in the army and with your friends and family, talking about it, being able to share how you felt.
I didn't. For years and years, I hid it. I was ashamed, you know, felt so much that I was useless, that I was worthless, that people wouldn't want to know me. And it got to the point, unfortunately, where I was medically discharged from the army. And I think at that point, I felt like I'd lost everything. You know, I'd lost my career, I'd lost the things that I loved doing. And so what else had I got to lose by telling people? Looking back now, it's very much one door closes, another one opens. And that's how I try and see it, because I wasn't doing well in that environment. And perhaps I wasn't around the right kind of people that could support me in that environment. But now that I've, I suppose, pushed my own boundaries by talking about it, yes, it was scary, but I've been so surprised by the reaction of other people. Some people who I maybe thought would be really understanding haven't necessarily been, and other people have been absolutely brilliant. So I think that has taught me to never judge anyone. You know, I think there's always lessons in life of anything that happens to us or we experience. It's taking those lessons and learning from them and moving forward is how I now try and live my life. I'm not saying that I always manage to do it, but that's certainly something that's come to the forefront, that I can ask myself, what can you learn from this? Where can this take you?
How did you find the strength to make those first tentative steps out of your room, out of your house, to go for a walk? Did that come from inside you, or did that come from having conversations that made you at least feel seen and understood?
I mean, it was the therapist. I was under the crisis team, you know, the psychiatrist, the medication. I'd been on medication and had therapy for quite a long time. But when it got really bad, the medication started to, I felt that there was one day where it kicked in. Because I had literally had 20 hours of every day just crying and just not wanting to be here. And the rest was sleeping, because I was on sleeping tablets as well. And it was sort of part of my care plan, really, with the team that were looking after me. And amazingly, one of the things, the top of the care plan, was I had to turn off all social media. It's not really that surprising. I think the actual trigger on the day when I was taken to hospital was because I'd looked at an image, and that image had physically had me dripping wet in sweat. It had me struggling to breathe. And so that was to be taken away. And then it was, you know, the crisis team saying, right, well, we're not going to come to your bedroom in your house, so you'll have to come downstairs. So once a day when they came to visit me, I suppose I had that little motivation that somebody was coming to visit. I mean, at this time, I had to move back to my parents because I was so unwell. But yeah, you know, sometimes it was just getting out of bed to clean my teeth. That would be a massive achievement in the day, or having a shower, not necessarily washing my hair in the shower, but managing a shower. And even though I was crying while I was in the shower, it was still a step further than I had managed the day before. And it's all still so vivid, those days of when things were so difficult. But I think that also helps me when I'm talking to other people, that I can take myself back to that place and put myself in their situation and go, I have an understanding. It will be different because it's different for everyone, but I still have that clear understanding of what it's like.
That was exactly actually what I was going to ask you, whether that the memory of that sits on your shoulder now in everything that you do.
Yeah, I think so. And I think definitely with some of the more difficult physical challenges that I do, if I'm getting to a tough time in that challenge, it's not a life or death situation. And I was in a life or death situation. And I think that becomes a driver as well of thinking, well, it's not as bad as, you know, it was when I was really ill. So yes, I have got that almost as a baseline now. So my other thing that I want is to never go back to that place again. And I feel myself slipping sometimes, but I feel that I've almost put the rungs of the ladder in place to catch me with the management strategies that I've got to help along the way.
And presumably, you know, you've got the safety nets in place that, you know, you've described that you realise you need, so that actually, you know, I mean, none of us ever feel great all the time, but we don't necessarily experience those extremes that you have. But actually, what you've managed to create for yourself is the awareness and the safety nets that you need to make sure that you stay on as even keel as possible.
But I've needed a lot of help to do that and to find that. And sometimes, you know, I actually have it written down on my phone of who are the people that make me feel good when I'm not in that situation. Because when you're asked those questions, when you're not in a great place, your brain is not able to function. And I always say to people, because I think this is a brilliant analogy, is that you wouldn't learn to swim in a storm. So my storm was when I was at crisis point, and there I was trying to learn all these new techniques that would help me. So we need to learn these techniques when we're actually well, whether that be breathing techniques, the people that are, we talk about drains and radiators. We all know there's people that we can be around that, you know, people make you feel good, but others drain us. And you know, knowing who those people are for yourselves is great, but just having that reminder on your phone. And another thing I have is I have a box that I've put in all the different things that make me feel good as a reminder. So it might be different smells, different textures, different visual things that remind me if I'm not having a great day, oh yeah, remember that person thought of you to send you that little gift, or that stone, we were on that beach that you really enjoyed, and just the texture of that stone brings back nice memories. So just really simple and small things that I've collected over time to be able to go, right, maybe it's a time that you need to go and just check out your box again, because it's not something I carry around with me all the time. But I suppose the list on my phone is almost like that little box of those memories, just little photographs of the people that I care about and care about me. I still take medication and I still see a therapist now, because I think my background as a physiotherapist knows the understanding that if I'm there with a patient, they'll do it well and they'll do it properly. And in the best will in the world, when they're not with me, they'll still try and do it, but they might not do it as often, as well. And I believe that's the same with my mental health. So to prevent me slipping back to that place, I just have that check-in every month to say, yeah, I'm doing okay. And it's brilliant if I can say that I'm doing well. But actually, times it's just to reflect on, well, hang on a minute. What were those techniques that you remember? You told me this, and remember, you told, you know, I told you that this is how you can manage things. So I think it's really important. And if I do slip into that really bad place, I haven't got to start new with someone else all over again, which is draining in itself, because this person now knows me, gets me, understands me. and we've built that relationship and that connection.
Such fantastic advice. I love the box idea because it's just all about bringing yourself back into the current moment and not allowing your thoughts to spiral in all kinds of different directions. It's focusing them in on something. I love that. I think we could all do with that, actually. Something physical that you can go and relate to that just focuses you in. That's a gorgeous, gorgeous thing.
Another thing I do is I have an email folder of just called nice emails that, again, you know, if I've had a lovely email, it gets filed into that folder that if I'm struggling, just go and have a look at some of the things that nice people have said to you or have done for you. And, you know, we all have laptops or phones accessible to us all the time. So that is something that you can carry around with you. If you sat on a train and you're suddenly feeling low, it's just there for you.
Brilliant. I love that. Those are such great techniques and ideas. Thank you for that. That's wonderful. What on earth propelled you into running at this stage in your life? Because, you know, in your 30s, things are a little more creaky necessarily, aren't they?
Yeah, it was just this strong desire previously. And I think I was working with people that they'd come in and they'd do a marathon. I'd be like, wow, I cannot believe you've done it, you know, a marathon. And I'd just have them up on this pedestal thinking, I just could never do that. And just slowly and surely in time, if I'm completely honest, I had a few glasses of wine and I decided maybe I'll give it a go and signed up. And that time I thought, you know, to make it more fun, I decided to do it as Supergirl. So I did it as a superhero and remember crossing that finishing line and just feeling for the first time in my life like a complete superhero, thinking never ever again. But it's a bit like childbirth. I don't have children, but everybody always says you kind of forget the pain of it and, you know, you remember the enjoyment. And so I was soon signed up to my next one, which is then why I thought I'll run as an orange. I'd already raised quite a lot of money and it was quite hard to think of something else to get people to dig deep into their pockets. And I thought, yeah, I'll be a great big giant orange. And that's when I got the Guinness World Record for the fastest marathon dressed as a piece of fruit.
Is that so? That's a different world record to the one dressed as a nut, right?
Yes, yeah. So I'm completely fruity and nuts. it was after about 50 marathons that someone said, you're completely nuts. And I thought, what a brilliant idea. So I got a peanut costume and had a sign on me that said, nuts about mental health, together we can crack it. Because I just believe that the more people that see or talk about it, then it just normalises it and people won't feel that stigma and shame about going and getting help and support. And that doesn't always need to be professional help or support. Just opening up to a friend or a partner or getting yourself outside prevents it getting to the point where you need professional help. So, yeah, I just kind of found a way that I realised, you know, it's fun. It makes people smile. And if I'm dressed as a orange, apple, banana, nut, cream cracker, because I've also been crackers, then they'll come and speak to me and ask me why. And it allows me that opportunity to say that I want to break that stigma associated with poor mental health. And more often than not, they end up saying to me, I've had a problem, or I know someone who's had a problem. So it just really subtly starts that conversation and hopefully makes them feel good and realise that if I'm there brightly coloured and smiling, then, you know, they can get back to that place as well. Because it's always nice to make people smile. And that's often what the costumes do.
I'd love to see your wardrobe. I'm telling you, you've got all these costumes hung up in a cupboard somewhere.
Yeah, it's a complete fruit salad.
And I also love the fact that you ever so casually dropped into the conversation there that, you know, on your 50th marathon. In fact, you've done 80, am I right in saying, or more than 80?
82 now, yes, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, I would suggest that a lot of people might very well understand the journey you took to your first marathon and that actually when you've done one, the adrenaline from doing one does, you know, propel you into more. But it doesn't generally have the effect that it appears to had on you, in that it's kind of triggered this extraordinary appetite and ability to take on these really, really hard challenges. You know, the things you've done, they are physically so extraordinarily demanding. And I'm really intrigued to understand what pushes you to keep doing these really hard things. I mean, a marathon is tough enough, but, you know, the marathon de Sable, the, you know, the skiing, you've done mountain climbing, you've done, I mean, truly, truly difficult things. What is it that pushes you to those extremes, do you think?
I think I've always got in the back of my mind how I felt and how bad I felt. And I just never want anyone else to feel like that. And also my job as a physiotherapist in the army, I saw some incredibly severely injured people who have limbs lost. And I just think, how lucky am I to have all of my limbs and the opportunity? And also, I love meeting people. And you go to these events and you meet so many people and you hear their stories. And it's just so humbling, because everybody who is doing an event, I don't call them races because it puts too much pressure on me. I just go to enjoy the event. People quite often will say to me, what time are you going for with a marathon or a cycle? And I tell them I'm just going for the time of my life. Because if I have a 4-hour time that I need to get, then that puts pressure and anxiety on myself. And I know that I don't do well in that state. But I'm in control of whether or not I have a good time. And that might be that I see someone else struggling and I'm able to run alongside them and chat and distract them. So I think it's, yeah, the people that I meet, the places that I've been able to go and visit, I quite often combine a marathon with a holiday. So, and a glass of wine.
Good to hear that.
Yes, yeah, before most marathons, you know, again, because I'm not an elite athlete, I'm not something special, you know, I'm not going to come first. And, you know, I get the same medal as the person who's come first or the person that's come last. But I'm not annoyed with myself, you know, if I haven't done the best. To me, a better, you know, a good result is that I've helped somebody else, I've raised money for charity, and that money can help other people who may be suffering and struggling as well. And I'm a bit of a charity tart in some ways, in that I have raised money for over 50 different charities, because there are so many charities. But what that means is I get to learn about that different charity. And then people will say, oh, I've got a problem, and I'm able to signpost them to a charity that will be beneficial to them, because it's not one, you know, one charity fits all. And so I feel like I'm able to help in a different way as well. And I think when I was at my lowest, even just the physical organisation of trying to get to a place took a lot of energy and time, but it was that small stepping stones again. And I often talk about small stepping stones, and particularly in the event that I did earlier this year, which was 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 consecutive days. And I think it was the 4th marathon, and it was in Dubai, because we'd started in Antarctica, but this one was in Dubai. And I was running down the boardwalk in Dubai, and I was in so much pain with my stomach. And I saw the lampposts along the boardwalk, and I thought, right, they're going to become my best friends. So I ran to a lamppost, and then I'd walk to the next one, and then I ran to one and walked it. I did that for 3 miles. I felt a little bit better after that, so I was then able to finish that marathon. I'd still got 3 more marathons to do, but if I in my mind had thought, right, I'm not going to be able to do this, I can't finish this marathon, let alone another 3, it's too overwhelming, and I would have just given up. But just literally that one lamppost, and also because I was feeling so unwell and so sick, I gave them hugs as well, so I'd stand along and have to hold on to them and give them a hug. So yeah, I remember those lampposts so well. But I think just, it's again, just such a message that when things are overwhelming, just to break things down and recognise, if you can do that, congratulate yourself, and then you can move forward. And it did get easier, and it did take away the pain, and I was able to continue and finish all of those 7 marathons.
That actually leads me into what I wanted to try and understand a little more, and that's what's going on, not just inside your head, but inside your body. I mean, these are such huge challenges mentally, as you've described, but also, as you've also referred to, you're a physiotherapist. You know what putting your body through these kinds of challenges is doing to it. How does it feel?
I have been very fortunate until 3 months before this, that big event of the 777, that I haven't had a huge amount of injuries. Now, this isn't going to sound right, but I don't really train for any of these events. And I think by that, it prevents me from getting stress injuries or, you know, getting injuries from doing too much. And I also use the different events to motivate me, because if I'm running a half marathon that's an organized event, I'm much more likely to finish that than if I say to myself, I'll go out for a 13-mile run, because I could easily turn round on that. Whereas in an event, it's harder. So again, that's just a strategy for me, that because I know I'm not that motivated to get up and go out every single day and run, that if I know I've got one on Sunday, that means at least I'm doing something once a week, even if I'm not doing it the 3 or 4 times that everybody else who's training for a marathon does.
I mean, now I'm picking my jaw up off the desk, because I can't believe that you take on these astonishing challenges and don't do all that kind of preparation and training. That's...
Yeah, but remember, I'm not quick. I'm not the fastest or the fittest. And I just say to people, you don't have to be the fastest or the fittest, but just go out, enjoy yourself, raise money for charity if that's what you want to do, and have fun. So it's a very different mindset to having to go out. So, you know, so much of it is mental, of telling yourself that you can do it. I've been there where I've been physically sick before a marathon because I've worried about it so much. But now I don't get that, because I genuinely believe that anybody, if they wanted to, could complete a marathon. And the reason I say that is we all have loved ones, you know, whether it's children, partners, family. And if any one of those people were in trouble and they were 26.2 miles away and there's no buses, planes, trains or anything, no public transport to be able to get to them, you would find a way of getting to them. It doesn't mean that we'd all get there at exactly the same time, and we don't need to get there in the same time. But I think if that drive and that desire of why you want to, that purpose is there, then you will achieve it.
So that's a brilliant way of describing the motivation for it. And of course, you're right that we probably all would do just that. I certainly wouldn't necessarily say that we all could run a marathon, but I understand the principle of it that you're explaining. You've also referred to the fact that what you're doing now and how you're doing it is giving you a real sense of purpose in your life. So not just the kind of campaigning, but, you know, the physical challenges that you set yourself. So I do wonder how it will feel, do you think, or do you ever think about it, when you can't do it anymore? Because there will come a point when you can't push yourself as hard as you are, and that, you know, you will have to dial down on perhaps the extremity of the challenges that you do. And I wonder if that's something you ever think about, and how you feel about it.
Great question, because I have sort of thought about it, but I think a lot of my treatment has, you know, that would cause me anxiety if I think about things too far forward. So anxiety is thinking about things that haven't actually happened yet, and depression is often thinking about things that have already happened. So I now try and live a lot more in the moment and actually just be grateful of the fact that I can do things at the moment. So on the fifth marathon of those 7, I remember they were tough, and another one I was walking and I was in tears from mile 7 because I was in so much pain with my stomach. And I was thinking to myself, if this was just my legs that were uncomfortable, I could understand it, but this is my stomach. But then I went, actually, Sally, you're so lucky to be here, to be able to walk. And there are people who would just give their right arm to be able to walk and do this. And actually on this event, there was an 80-year-old man who was doing 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. And so there's elements me, and he wasn't as fast as everybody else, but I don't think the 80 back in the day is the same as 80 now. And yes, maybe I'll just have to change to a different sport. So I, when I was struggling with the stress fracture prior to doing it 3 months before, I did a lot of swimming. And a swimming, it can be competitive, but it can also be recreational. And getting the value of being in the water, being with friends, feeling and hearing and, you know, using all your senses, you don't have to be going fast to do that. And I think it's making sure that you can still get that social part of it, of, you know, being with other people, or the quietness, if that's what you want, because some people like to do things alone. I was on an event the other week. It was a sponsored walk, and somebody was on their own, and I said, are you okay walking on your own? Do you want to? She went, believe me, I've got 4 children. This is absolute bliss. So again, never judging what other people want or think, because we all do things a bit differently.
That's such an invaluable insight, as has everything you've said during this conversation, Sally. I do want to ask you, though, how you pick the challenges you decide to do and what's next on the list.
So I pick them by things that come up. You know, sometimes you'll get emails into an inbox, or I'll see inspiration from other people and think, oh, that looks good, either to do by myself or with other people. I was part of a team last week that swam the channel, and that was with a group of individuals who had all had disabilities. So the main founder of the charity that I was swimming for had had a massive stroke, so could only use one side of his body. And being involved in something when you're supporting other people and allowing other people to reach their goals and dreams and things that they thought that they would never be able to do, that is something that I love doing. In answer to the second part of your question, having taken that mental health message all around the world, because I feel there is an endemic of you know, problems with mental health, I now want to take it to the top of the world, both geographically and topographically. So I'm hoping next year to do the North Pole Marathon, which I have actually been waiting for the last 4 years, but it's been cancelled every year, but also the Everest Marathon as well, because I really want to shout it from the top of the world that if people need help, get that help and just talk to people, because unfortunately I have had friends take their lives through suicide, and I've known of the ripple effect of that on so many other people that, you know, I want to help stop that.
Sally, thank you so much for shouting about your message. I'm sorry we couldn't do it from Everest, but I hope that just by everybody listening to this, they will have a better understanding and feel more supported and able to go and get the help they need if they need it.
Oh, thank you, Diane.
I can't let you go, though, without asking you the 4 questions we ask all our guests on The Extraordinary Ordinary. The first one is, who is or are the woman or women who have inspired you in your life?
Great question. So I think I would have to say my mum, bringing up 4 kids under the age of 5 and being a primary school teacher and just having a smile on her face the whole time. Not sporty in the slightest. And the other person I would say is actually Catherine Granger, because just her dedication, her tenacity, her keeping going. I think she's slightly younger than me, but yeah, just watching that drive and that determination in everything she does, whether there be that sport, academic, or, you know, just friendships and people and speaking, the way that she conducts herself, really.
Yeah, she's a fantastic woman. She's a very big supporter of Women of the Year too. We're very grateful for that. So we love her at Women of the Year. So question number 2, what advice would you give your younger self?
I think I'd say to my younger self that you are good enough, and don't ever let anyone else tell you that you're not good enough, because I've played this internal tune that you're not good enough for years and years and years. And we're all different. And there's no point comparing yourself to anyone else, because you're just you and you can only be you. So, yeah, you are good enough just the way you are.
Lovely advice. Thank you. Question number 3. What's the one thing you can't live without?
Now, this is going to sound very strange for a nearly 50-year-old, but it's actually my teddy bear. I still sleep with my teddy bear every single night.
And it's the best answer. That's wonderful. Do you know when you were given your teddy bear?
Yeah, it was when I was born. But actually, at the age of 7 years old, my teddy bear is actually named after what was my best friend at the time, which is Tracy. And yeah, she has been all over the world with me. She's been to Afghanistan, she's done skydives with me because I didn't want to leave her in my bag in case anything happened. So I thought, well, I'll just put her in my pocket when I did the skydive. And, yeah.
And finally, the answer to the last question is probably the answer to the last question. What's one thing about you that would surprise people to know?
Probably that I have drank somebody else's pee. It wasn't on purpose. But when I was doing the Marathon de Saab, I'd been really quite unwell on the first day. So I'd vomited. And then on the second day, I had really bad diarrhea. And on the third day, in the middle of the night, I was so thirsty. So I just grabbed a drink and I thought, oh, gosh, that doesn't taste right. And so I got a different bottle of water instead. And then in the morning, my tent mate, there was eight of us in this tent. And this guy had put his water bottle on my sleeping bag. And I said, what electrolyte drink are you using? He said, oh, no, you don't want to drink that. I said, no, I already have. And it dawned on me that he couldn't take the 20 steps out of the tent to go for a pee. And I had taken a big slug of this big gulp of that. So the whole tent erupted in laughter. And then the next tent and the next tent. And on the final day, we were at the airport and somebody said to me, how did you find it? And I said, well, at the first day, I vomited. On the second day, I had diarrhea. On the third day, I drank my tent mate's pee. And he was like, oh, my goodness, that was you. He said, you got me through the whole Marathon de Saab, because whenever I was thinking I'm really struggling, I just thought, at least I'm not that girl who's drank her tent mate's pee. So what I say is, you never know when you're inspiring somebody else.
So we've had some very memorable answers to that question, Sally, but I think you might just have shot to the top of the list.
I don't recommend it. And everyone used to say to me, oh, Bear Grylls would be really impressed. And I was like, no, Bear Grylls tells you to drink your own pee, not somebody else's.
Sally, keep on doing what you do. Keep on doing your fabulous, mad, brilliant, extraordinary challenges. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on The Extraordinary Ordinary today. And we wish you the very best of luck with everything. And especially in November, when you get your very, very well-deserved MBE.
Oh, thank you, Diane, so much. It's been really lovely to chat to you. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review us, as it helps people to find us. To find out more about Women of the Year, go to womenoftheyear.co.uk. This episode was presented by me, Diane Kenwood, and produced by Claire Lynch. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. They're one of the leading consumer goods companies in the world, making, moving, and selling some of the world's most loved brands. CCEP make, employ, manufacture, and distribute locally, maintaining a strong commitment to their communities. CCEP's success depends on their people. They want CCEP to be a great place to work, where people can grow, be happy and be well in a safe, open, diverse and inclusive workplace.